This is Stephen Heller, The New Gnosis, November 4th, 1985.
Speaking on The New Gnosis, Jung and Modern Gnosticism. Many of you, I think, were here last year when he spoke to us, and I think most who heard him will come back again because he is really not only a very informative but very entertaining person to listen to. we like to pick our heretics very carefully, and we honor him by asking him to speak with us. Dr. Heller is author of The Gnostic Jung and Seven Sermons to the Dead. He is from Los Angeles. He's a bishop in the Gnostic Church, and he's director of the Gnostic Society in Los Angeles. So now I'd like to introduce Mr. Heller.
Dear fellow Jungians and fellow Gnostics, which, while some of you might not agree, in my mind is pretty much the same thing. I'm very happy to be here once again, and it seems, as we were looking over the program, that I was in an extremely ambitious mood when I sent the little description of the topic to your program chair lady, and so I have a tremendous number of ideas to cover, it will seem. How well I can do that, I don't know, but there's only one way to find out, and that is to begin. So, first of all, I think we need to take a look at, for our purposes, very briefly, we need to take a look at the relationship of Dr. Jung himself as a person to Gnosticism, which is really a subject which I think I covered to some extent about a year ago when I was here last. And so perhaps we only need to refresh our memory regarding that. It is rather well known, I think, to most people who are somewhat familiar with Jung's life, that from the very early period of his life on Earth, really from the time of his early youth, from the time that he first heard about it, in fact, he had a great fascination for and abiding interest in the Gnostics and in Gnosticism. Barbara Hanna, in her very perceptive and intimate biographical work of Jung, concerning Jung, mentions that he said to her in personal conversation that when he encountered, by way of his studies and reading, the Gnostics, he immediately felt that he had found old friends. That's a fairly direct statement. I will just throw another statement at you, which appeared in a little book. In fact, my attention to that statement and to that book my attention was called to it here in Seattle a number of years ago, that was published by the San Francisco Jung Institute, and it's entitled, I think, C.G. Jung, Emma Jung, Tony Wolf. And in it, there is a statement which originally came from my countryman, and curiously enough, a friend of my father's, the late Professor Carl Carini, the great mythologist, who said that when questioned about his religious interests or his religion, Jung was one to view himself as the Pope of the Gnostics. A statement of that sort is apt to come from a Hungarian. But again, knowing something of Professor Carini, he wasn't the kind of man who would have repeated a statement of that sort unless it had a profound meaning and it really pertained to Jung's spiritual and religious views. Jung was led from his study and his involvement in Gnosticism quite directly, and as probably we may find out in a few minutes, very significantly to the study of alchemy, purely on the basis of intuitive and synchronistic guidance, although of course subsequently I think he came to discover that one, namely alchemy, was in a very important way the continuation of the other, namely Gnosticism. Jung was also responsible, as you know, within that very critical and transformative period of his own life, at the time when he left Sigmund Freud and then was on his own and underwent a great and turbulent inner Gnostic experience, for writing a very curious and very mysterious little treatise called Septem Sermones ad Mortuos, or the Seven Sermons to the Dead, written completely in the language and using the thought world, the cosmo-conception of second or third century Gnosticism. These were, let's say, the basic data in Jung's life relating to Gnosticism. But there was much more to it than that. When, in 1945, right after World War II, the famous Nag Hammadi Gnostic Library was discovered in Egypt. It was very largely due to Jung's interest and Jung's influence that marvelous and now increasingly well publicized and translated deposit corpus of Gnostic writings, of Gnostic gospels and teachings, did not suffer the same fate that the Dead Sea Scrolls suffered, namely a fate of obscurity and deliberate or not deliberate disappearance, concealment, but rather that it came to be translated and came to be publicized, for it was Jung's close associate and friend, Professor Gilles Quispel from Holland, whom I hope to see in about a couple of weeks' time when he's coming to Los Angeles to speak for us and attending one of the Gnostic conferences there, who had acquired, first found and verified and then acquired in behalf of the Jung Institute and the Bollingen Foundation, one of the books of the Nag Hammadi collection, which was spirited out of Egypt and which came to be known as the Jung Codex, and which contains such important materials as the Gospel of Truth, originally probably attributed to the great Gnostic teacher Valentinus, and a number of other writings. And it is now grudgingly but openly acknowledged by the majority of Gnostic scholars throughout the world that had it not been for Jung and his friends, all of this in all likelihood would not have happened. So the connection between Jung and the Gnostics, the connection between Jung and Gnosticism is historically verified. But there is much more to it than that. Jung came to discover and to pioneer an idea which up to his time and up to our time was considered to be a total impossibility. And that is what, in our little description of this evening's talk, I call a secret principle underlying Gnosticism. Now, here I need to say a few things in general terms about the worldview, the orientation of the Gnostics. First of all, very quickly, who were the Gnostics? The Gnostics were a variant group, a school of thought within early Christianity. It is simply not true. More than that, it is an abominable lie to say or to hold that the Gnostics were originally, to begin with, considered to be deviants or heretics from the main body of Christendom. It is simply not true. They were, until the well into the middle and the latter part of the 3rd century, for the most part, accepted members of the various Christian communities. There was no uniform Christianity then any more than there is one now. But it was a diversified, pluralistic situation. So this was one particular school. And if you want to characterize for our purposes in contemporary terms what kind of a school it was a psychologically oriented school of Christianity, to the extent that we can talk about psychology in those early times. Some people have called the Gnostics proto-psychologists, which just doesn't have anything to do with protein, really, except that it originates in a similar Greek word, but it merely means early forerunners of psychology. These were people who looked at religious and religious myths, religious scriptures, religious rituals and sacraments, and in their own way immediately tended to interpret them what today we would call psychological, as pertaining to the interior transformative movements and structures of the human soul. Professor Quispel has a very nice little short, concise statement, which I will paraphrase. He says, Gnosticism, Gnosis, always originates in immediate, first-hand, personal spiritual experience, which then is inevitably translated into myth. And I have suggested to him that a little more could be added to that statement by saying is translated into myth and then is usually implemented in ritual. And he agreed. I'll try to confront him with that again in a couple of weeks, see if he still agrees. That's a very concise definition of the entire school. Now, the spiritual experiences of Gnosis, which in Greek just Gnosis, G-N-O-S-I-S, simply means knowing, but knowing in an other than intellectual or scientific sense, an interior knowing. The Greeks had a number of rather specific terms describing what today we would call psychological or then might have been called philosophical experiences and concepts. The Greek language was a very rich language when dealing with such matters. And so they had a special word for it, gnosis. Now, this gnosis, this knowingness, expressed itself in a number of major mythological themes that the Gnostics apparently knew or felt that the kind of thing that they were dealing with, the kind of interior spiritual experiences which they had and tried to express, could not be profitably expressed in any other way than in myth. That to put these in direct declarative theological terms, let's say, would detract from it, would take something away from it. And if you know anything about theology, and if you have suffered for a number of years of seminary, as I have, which still makes me shudder, I think that the seminaries and divinity schools are sort of the concrete modern-day manifestation of the crown of thorns. They inevitably give you a frightful headache for the rest of your life. All you have to do is just think about them. And I went to some very famous ones, including the Gregorian University in Rome. In any event, then you, if you had some of that experience, then you would readily agree with me that theology has been justly defined as knowing all about God and nothing of God. So the Gnostics apparently already knew this fact in an intuitive fashion, and so they could not translate the transcendental, the Gnostic experience into prose. They could translate it, they felt, to some extent, into poetic myth. And so there were a number of major mythic structures with which they worked. This is, incidentally, pretty much within at least some of the framework of the ancient world and of the late period of the ancient world, but in German we call Spätantike, which is the Alexandrian or the Hellenistic period when the Gnostics lived. And one of these myths is one that was very difficult for people in the modern world to deal with, and it is the dualistic myth. The Gnostics were accused by their detractors, the later so-called Orthodox Christians, as having been dualists. This is what we always heard. The Gnostics worshipped spirit and were against man. They tried to get to heaven and tried to get away from earth. That they said that earth and materiality in the body were evil and that these things have to be overcome and left behind and things like that. So, this was the common belief concerning that aspect of the Gnostic myth at the time of Jung. Jung somehow felt that this was not true. Not only wouldn't he, of course, personally agree with it, because he had a great mystical quality to see what the medieval alchemists and the natural philosophers of the Middle Ages called the lumen naturae, the light of nature. He could perceive that light coming out of the mountains and the rocks of Switzerland and out of the trees and out of the lakes and everywhere. So he certainly could not agree with any notion that this physical world or the world of nature is evil. But he also intuitively knew that the Gnostics did not mean that. Even though all the professors and all the preachers and the church historians said so. And then Jung discovered an actual historical link between the Gnostics, people like Valentinus and Basilides and Carpocrates and Marcion and all of this band of old teachers back there in the 2nd and 3rd century and thereabouts, and what came to become such an extremely important discipline of spiritual transformation for a long time in Western history, and which became one of the chief embodiments or symbol systems of Jung's own psychology, alchemy. He found a person, scholar and magician and alchemist by the name of Zosimos of Panopolis in the 3rd century. And he found out that Zosimos was a Gnostic, who translated the Gnostic myths into the mythic and practical structure of alchemy. Now, if Zosimos could do that, then the two could not be contradictory to each other. And here is something that very few people have really creatively dealt with, although it's implicit in all of Jung's alchemical writings, Psychology and Alchemy, Mysterium Conjunctionis, Alchemical Studies, for that matter, in Answer to Job, namely that there is an interpretation, an understanding of that principle of dualism, which is part of alchemy, but which is very different from the nasty accusations made against the Gnostics before. And it is simply this, that the Gnostics were not radical dualists advocating a static form of dualism, and I'll say in a minute what I mean by that, but that they envisioned very much the same thing that the alchemists envisioned, and something that Jung has brought back, I think, with magnificent force into the picturing of reality of the modern world, and which I think still needs to sink into the collective unconscious and do its work in our world, namely the principle of creative dualism. Creative or dynamic dualism. Now, static dualism or radical dualism is the kind of thing that to some extent, although even there it's a falsification, people tend to project into the old Zoroastrian religion of Persia. It is commonly believed, but it's not really true, that Zoroastrianism established the idea that there are eternal, immutable, and forever conflicting principles of good and evil in the world. Good and evil are forever fighting each other, and the world is the, and history is the ongoing arena of this great titanic battle. A lot of this idea is incidentally filtered into Orthodox Christianity by way of Augustine and other people. Now, so what that amounts to is that these principles are there, they fight with each other, but nothing really happens other than the conflict. There are such things in life, if we look at it psychologically, because much conflict, as psychology will tell us, is, just neurotic conflict, conflicts that tear us apart, nothing good comes out of it. And that's the kind of conflict which we should somehow end. We should get out of it. But on the other hand, I'm sure that most of us are aware that there are many conflictual situations in life and in the psyche which are in the nature of at least a potentially creative conflict. So that when we bear the conflict instead of bolting and running away too quickly, then out of the interaction, the struggle, the embraces and the struggles and the fights of the opposites, the polarities within our minds, within our psyche, a new result arises, a new creative development, a new insight, and ultimately perhaps a new self. This is the principle of creative dualism. This is the Gnostic principle of creative dualism which Jung has discovered, and which is of course very clearly manifest once you see it in alchemy, but which is really the direct continuation of the Gnostic myth. So that what we are really dealing with here is an understanding that the way spiritual growth, transformation, salvation, if you please, works in the world is not by a unidirectional linear progress. We have been bad, now we shall be good. We have been stupid, now we shall be wise. We have been childish, now we shall be mature. But rather that there are always arise at a certain point of spiritual growth and transformation certain interacting, intercommunicating dualities, binaries. In alchemy, we first have to reduce the false cosmos of matter to the so-called prima materia, a kind of chaotic psychic condition. And then out of that chaos, like the primeval dragons in the book of Revelation, there arise the dualities who begin to interact with each other. As the result of their interaction, eventually comes the philosopher's stone, the new being, out of conflict. It wasn't a totally new concept, even in the days of the Gnostics. It is really but an application and a further development of the creative philosophy of Heraclitus in Greece, the pre-Socratic philosopher, whom Jung incidentally valued much more highly than Plato or Aristotle. Jung didn't even like the Neoplatonists very much, because he said that they were too intellectual, they were too ready to take off into intellectual categorizations and come to regard these as realities instead of the spiritual, empirical spiritual experience of the individual. So Jung put his finger on this great creative principle and the principle of creative dualism, and he did so, moreover, at a time when there was practically no direct objective verification of this available in terms of ancient Gnosticism. But behold, 1945-46, the Nag Hammadi scriptures began to come forth, and we find verse after verse and stanza after stanza of statements in these writings of the ancient Gnostics indicating that the Gnostic view of Christianity was precisely of this nature, wherein Jesus himself is made to say, I have come to make the two into the one, to make the above and the below and the inner and the outer and the male and the female, and in some of the scriptures by implication even the good and the evil, into a single one. And that this will be the renewal. This will be the soteria, the healing, which is the original term for salvation. You know, even the English term salvation comes from salus, Latin, a word which means health. You have such terms as salubrious, is something healthy, the salubrious air of Seattle versus the noxious air, let's say, of Los Angeles. But I can tell you something, those of us who live in that noxious air have a hard time breathing here. I came here, I was perfectly all right, and since I've been here, I've been coughing. You know, I can't take it. Also, you have to realize that we have certain ways we can sort of divine things by the small. Small divination. Soon I shall write a book about it. After all, we have tarot and I Ching and runes, and people are divining by all kinds of things now. I think that I will write two books. One is for vegetarians only, how to divine by the entrails of animals. going back to Roman times and so forth, you know, the harvest species. And the other one, of course, will be to divine by the small. One of the things that happens is that you can tell the seasons. In the spring, the smog turns green. We have mostly palm trees and things like that, so we don't have all the nice leaves that turn brown and gold, but the smog does. So we are okay. But that really has rather little relationship to gnosis, except that perhaps you can go into a somewhat altered state by inhaling enough smog. Somewhat like the Delphic oracle sitting on a tripod when the fumes are rising out of the caverns of Delphi. We have received now, let's say, the verification of the fact that that salvation, that healing, is the healing of the divisions which exist within the human soul, and by way of projection, perhaps in the external universe as well. So that the Gnostics, very much like modern analytical or Jungian psychology, have recognized that there is something wrong with us. All of us. We're sick. And that sickness consists in a divided state. We are split. There are splits within us. This split has been given all kinds of names. Spirit and matter. Body and soul, male and female, good and evil, left and right, up and down, old and young, you know, you can go on and on and on. But the purpose of, let's say, spiritual life, spiritual growth, is really only one thing: to bring about a healing, a holding, a making one of these divisions. And the Gnostics said that was the job of Jesus Christ. Just as simple as that. Not to make people good. Jehovah tried to do that with very poor success for a few thousand years. You know, he dragged poor old Moses up on the mountain and handed him all kinds of tablets. And as we used to say in the 60s, he took those tablets and came down and all the children of Israel got stoned. Well, tablets. And they were moreover stone tablets. But if I keep this up, I think you are going to become increasingly dissatisfied with the triviality of the things that I am saying. aside from the levity, there is a real break in the emphasis of spirituality. And Jung recognized that, to the discomfort, really, of quite a few people. Initially, to the discomfort of, sort of agnostic and atheistically oriented people who were plentiful in the psychoanalytical movement, and also to the discomfort of people who were not Christians. He said, something tremendously unique happened psychologically at the beginning of the Christian era. He didn't say that Jesus Christ was the only begotten Son of God, but he said that, and I'm sure you had a number, I just saw you had a number of lectures recently on the relationship of Jung to Christianity, so I'm supposed to be the Gnostic, I shouldn't go into all of that, others have, Murray Stein and so forth. But he did say that Jesus became a unique projection, a unique manifestation of the healing, unifying, messianic archetype. That's what he was. And to a very great extent still is. That was the power. That is not to say that there were not many more before him. Dying and resurrecting savior gods, all that sort of thing. Osiris, Tammuz, okay. But it just somehow didn't come together. It didn't congeal until that particular time. It was the right archetype manifesting at the right moment in history, and it just caused a tremendous explosion, a tremendous popular enthusiasm, because it responded to a very profound inner need of humanity. Now, so this is the principle of creative dualism, which certain third factors, which in alchemy are known as the spirit of Mercury, and which in the Christian framework is the figure of Christ, the Mercurius, the Hermes of the Christian framework come about. Now, the radical break is simply this, that prior to that time it was constantly assumed, particularly by the Jewish tradition, but by many other religious traditions too, that the way to achieve spiritual growth, the way to conform to the will of God, is to be good. To be good. Of course, according to the standards of the particular people who told you, and that wasn't always the same thing. To be good according to Jewish and Christian standards is to have one wife, let's say for a man, obviously, or not so obviously, be faithful and so forth, and sort of vegetate in that situation. But to be good in Islam is to have four, and then some of those you can kick out two and bring others and so forth, but it's still being good, of course. So the details of how to be good vary, but the idea is that you are saved by being good, which means primarily two things: to believe the right things from the Torah, from the Quran, from the Gospels, whatever, and to do the right things according to the commandments. But now the Gnostic emphasis came in, and he said, and they said, that at best is a preparation. That is a prefiguration of the true religious task, which is not to be good, but to become one, to become unified. That's what. And there the whole business of being good and to believe the right things is no longer important. So there is the tremendous convergence of Jung's recognitions and the teachings of the ancient Gnostics. Another tremendously important factor is the recovery and the rebirth of the feminine within the spiritual structure. A tremendously important part of Gnosticism. Once again, prior to the time of the Gnostics, the feminine and the masculine emphasis were tremendously split from each other. The common assumption is, you can find it in the psychohistorical writings of Erich Neumann, for instance, who I think is one of the greatest and most creative disciples of Jung, maybe a little bit neglected nowadays. You know, various people are coming forth now, passing themselves off as the great creative geniuses coming out of the Jungian thought. There was one already, much greater than anybody now, Neumann. Absolutely marvelous and wonderful material. And Neumann put forth, you know, the psychohistorical scheme that there were ages, aeons, periods in the psychohistorical development which correspond to the development of the individual in our own life cycle to some extent even now. So the age of the great mother, prior to that the original unformed so-called Uroboric stage, then the age of the great mother, then the age of the great father, and finally the integrative phase. Now, the Gnostics, it would seem, were really the exponents, perhaps somewhat historically premature exponents, visionary exponents, a couple of thousand years ahead of their time in many ways, of the integrative phase. They said that the most helpful spiritual myth which can help us to unite our interior being is neither feminine nor masculine, nor impersonal, but a combination of all of these. It doesn't have to be this segment of the pie and that segment of the pie when you look at this as a kind of a circular mandala, but it can be all of these together. And of course, the grand symbol of that is the reconciliation and the union within the human psyche of the anima and the animus. To make the male and the female into a single one, says Jesus in the Gospel of Thomas, and is repeated in various places. Moreover, it is quite well established that at least some of the greatest and most sophisticated Gnostic schools, particularly the one of Valentinus, had practiced a sacrament. The sacrament was known as the sacrament of the bride chamber or bridal chamber. And here, ritually and sacramentally, they were uniting the masculine and the feminine component in the same individual. Incidentally, just by way of explaining that, it is quite well established that way back at that time, the Gnostic scriptures already indicated all the seven sacraments of the later Christian church were already in existence and were practiced by the Gnostics. That's in the Gospel of Philip. But two were of a different and much more esoteric character. One was the bridal chamber, the unification of the masculine and the feminine component, and another one was the sacrament of the redemption, or apolytrosis, as it is called in Greek, which was the final renunciation of the limitations of the external cosmos. And it appears to our research that that occurred subsequent to the sacrament of the bride chamber. So when the individual has become one, then he could say no to the tyranny of the world, the tyranny of the outer cosmos, which of course means the false and deceptive picturing of reality that the ego has brought about. Because the ego is the false creator of the world. Not that the ego is not important, but until the self comes into his own or its own within the psyche, the ego projects a false world. That is why psychic reality, up to the point that that individuation really takes place, psychic reality is always somewhat superior to external or physical reality. Why? Because the physical external reality is so full of projections that we don't know what we are seeing. And since we have a division and chaos inside of us, we perceive division and chaos and falsity outside there. That incidentally puts a lot of Eastern ideas, such as the Hindu concept of Maya, the illusion, into a much more, or the Buddhist notion of samsara, into a much more intelligible psychological position. It's not that the world is an illusion, but the world as you see it is an illusion until you become disillusioned yourself inside of you. Because most of us don't want to do that. When we have become, however, unified and we have that gnosis, then we see the inside and the outside just as they are, without any projections, negative or positive, one thing or the other. Very, very important matter. Now, within this unification, of course, the feminine played a tremendous role. And so the Gnostics were not, as maybe some people are nowadays, radical neo-pagans who wanted to bring back the great goddess and things like that. That is, as many good friends as I have who are witches, especially around Halloween, they kind of tend to come out, and so forth. Much of the that kind of one-sided neo-pagan mythos has its hazards. One of the hazards being that it can become retrogressive. We can go back to a goddess image that is very chthonic, very ancient, namely the great mother, the Magna Mater, that Erich Neumann speaks about way, way back in the time of history. And, you know, if you investigate a little bit of what went on, in those places, in those countries, way back when the great mother ruled, I tell you, very few of us would want to live in that world. Because in some ways, an extremely alluring, seductive, and beautiful situation. In other ways, it is the pits of horrors. You know, I mean, I don't know. Friday the 13th, part 6 is nothing compared to what is going on around there. So you can see what kind of movies I go to, but then I live in Hollywood, you know. Because it is a very primitive situation where the womb and the tomb, the birth-giving and the devouring, the beautiful and the horrible are all together in one. So the Gnostics dealt with a much more different shape, much more beautiful, much more wise feminine images, goddess images, and they were more or less subsumed in a figure which the Gnostics in Greek, since that was the lingua franca, the language of the educated people at that time in the late Roman Empire rather than Latin, that's where the New Testament was written in Greek. They called this feminine figure Sophia, wisdom. Once again, it started a bit earlier. It started with such documents within the first century BC, just before the Christian era, as the Book of the Wisdom of Solomon. Of course, Solomon didn't write it, King Solomon, it's just attributed to him. Other items of the wisdom literature, in Hebrew this figure was called Chokmah, wisdom. And that was then translated into Greek as Sophia. And already in the Book of the Wisdom of Solomon, this Chokmah is always addressed as she. And he's called the beloved and the consort of God. And all of the things that relate to wisdom and beauty and inspiration and prophecy are done by way of Sophia. She is the one, if you just look at the Book of the Wisdom, who does all these things. Makes people into friends of God. So God, the God of the Old Testament in this case, works through Sophia. So we already have that image of the feminine wisdom, which is, you might say, is the effulgence, the light in overshadowing light in Hebrew called Shekinah of God that comes down and overshadows humanity. So that it's really the divine woman who brings the mysteries to the individual and not the masculine God himself. This was a development in sort of esoteric Judaism at that time, which then found its full expression and flowering among the Gnostics. But these and many other elements which came forth at that time were, they were simply not acceptable to an awful lot of people, even as they are not acceptable to many people today. I'm quite sure that if outstanding gentleman, the Reverend Jerry Falwell, would have the unique misfortune, well, it would be probably our misfortune, if he were here and would hear this, would definitely put us on the bottom of the top or whatever, in the darkest point of the blacklist of the moral majority movement. Maybe we are there already. These things are unacceptable to certain kinds of minds, and they were unacceptable then. And then, of course, as most of you know, there are certain historical developments took place whereby the people who wanted to adhere to the old concepts, to Jehovah's law, rather than to the new law, took over. And while they maintained the trappings of Christianity, they really perpetuated that which the Christian religion was designed to supplant and do away with. And there went, of course, by the wayside, the Gnostics. But as Jung, of course, wisely pointed out, these transformative and creative ideas never really disappeared. They were assistance of certain third factors, which in alchemy are known as the spirit of Mercury, and which in the Christian framework is the figure of Christ, the Mercurius, the Hermes of the Christian framework come about. Now, the radical break is simply this, that prior to that time it was constantly assumed, particularly by the Jewish tradition, but by many other religious traditions too, that the way to achieve spiritual growth, the way to conform to the will of God is to be good. To be good. Of course, according to the standards of the particular people who told you, and that wasn't always the same thing. To be good according to Jewish and Christian standards is to have one wife, let's say for a man, obviously, or not so obviously, be faithful and so forth, and sort of vegetate in that situation. But to be good in Islam is to have four, and then some of those you can kick out too and bring others and so forth, but it's still being good, of course. So the details of how to be good vary, but the idea is that you are saved by being good, which means primarily two things: to believe the right things from the Torah, from the Quran, from the Gospels, whatever, and to do the right things according to the commandments. But now the Gnostic emphasis came in, and they said that at best is a preparation. That is a prefiguration of the true religious task, which is not to be good, but to become one, to become unified. That's what it is. And there the whole business of being good and to believe the right things is no longer important. So there is the tremendous convergence of Jung's recognitions and the teachings of the ancient Gnostics. Another tremendously important factor is the recovery and the rebirth of the feminine within the spiritual structure. A tremendously important part of Gnosticism. Once again, prior to the time of the Gnostics, the feminine and the masculine emphasis were tremendously split from each other. The common assumption is, you can find it in the psychohistorical writings of Erich Neumann, for instance, who I think is one of the greatest and most creative disciples of Jung, maybe a little bit neglected nowadays. You know, various people are coming forth now, passing themselves off as the great creative geniuses coming out of the Jungian thought. There was one already much greater than anybody known, Neumann. Absolutely marvelous and wonderful material. And Neumann put forth, you know, the psychohistorical scheme that there were ages, aeons, periods in the psychohistorical development which correspond to the development of the individual in our own life cycle to some extent even now. So the age of the great mother, prior to that the original unformed so-called uroboric stage, then the age of the great mother, then the age of the great father, and finally the integrative phase. Now, the Gnostics, it would seem, were really the exponents, perhaps somewhat historically premature exponents, visionary exponents, a couple of thousand years ahead of their time in many ways, of the integrative phase. They said the most helpful spiritual myth which can help us to unite our interior being is neither feminine nor masculine nor impersonal, but a combination of all of these. It doesn't have to be this segment of the pie and that segment of the pie when you look at this as a kind of a circular mandala, but it can be all of these together. And of course, the grand symbol of that is the reconciliation and the union within the human psyche of the anima and the animus. To make the male and the female into a single one, says Jesus in the Gospel of Thomas, and is repeated in various places. Moreover, it is quite well established that at least some of the greatest and most sophisticated Gnostic schools, particularly the one of Valentinus, had practiced a sacrament. The sacrament was known as the sacrament of the bride chamber or bridal chamber. And here, ritually and sacramentally, they were uniting the masculine and the feminine component in the same individual. Incidentally, just by way of explaining that, it is quite well established that way back at that time, the Gnostic scriptures already indicate that all the seven sacraments of the later Christian church were already in existence and were practiced by the Gnostics. That's in the Gospel of Philip. But two were of a different and much more esoteric character. One was the bridal chamber, the unification of the masculine and the feminine component, and another one was the sacrament of the redemption, or apolytrosis, as it is called in Greek, which was the final renunciation of the limitations of the external cosmos. And it appears to our research that that occurred subsequent to the sacrament of the bride chamber. So when the individual has become one, then he could say no to the tyranny of the world, the tyranny of the outer cosmos, which of course means the false and deceptive picturing of reality that the ego has brought about. Because the ego is the false creator of the world. Not that the ego is not important, but until the self comes into his own or its own within the psyche, the ego projects a false world. That is why psychic reality, up to the point that individuation really takes place, psychic reality is always somewhat superior to external or physical reality. Why? Because the physical and external reality is so full of projections that we don't know what we are seeing. And since we have a division and chaos inside of us, we perceive division and chaos and falsity outside there. That incidentally puts a lot of Eastern ideas, such as the Hindu concept of Maya, the illusion, into a much more, for the Buddhist notion of samsara, he means a much more intelligible psychological position. It's not that the world is an illusion, but the world as you see it is an illusion until you become this illusion yourself inside of you. Because most of us don't want to do that. And when we have become, however, unified and we have that gnosis, then we see the inside and the outside just as they are, without any projections, negative or positive. Very, very important matter. Now, within this unification, of course, the feminine played a tremendous role. And so the Gnostics were not, as maybe some people are nowadays, radical neo-pagans who wanted to bring back the great goddess and things like that. That is, as many good friends as I have who are witches, especially around Halloween, they tend to come out, and so forth. Much of the that kind of one-sided neo-pagan mythos has its hazards. One of the hazards being that it can become retrogressive. We can go back to a goddess image that is very chthonic, very ancient, namely the great mother, the Magna Mater, that Erich Neumann speaks about way, way back in the time of history. And, you know, if you investigate a little bit of what went on in those places, in those countries way back when the great mother ruled, I tell you, very few of us would want to live in that world. Because it is in some ways an extremely alluring, seductive, and beautiful situation. In other ways, it is the pits of horrors. You know, I mean, I don't know, Friday the 13th, part 6 is nothing compared to what is going on around there. So you can see what kind of movies I go to, but then I live in Hollywood, you know. Because it is a very primitive situation where the womb and the tomb, the birth-giving and the devouring, the beautiful and the horrible are all together in one. So the Gnostics dealt with a much more differentiated, much more beautiful, a much more wise feminine images, goddess images. And they were more or less subsumed in a figure which the Gnostics in Greek, since that was the lingua franca, the language of the educated people at that time in the late Roman Empire rather than Latin. That's where the New Testament was written in Greek. They called this feminine figure Sophia, wisdom. Once again, it started a bit earlier. It started with such documents within the first century BC, just before the Christian era, as the Book of the Wisdom of Solomon. Of course, Solomon didn't write it, King Solomon, it's just attributed to him. Other items of the wisdom literature, in Hebrew this figure was called Chokmah, wisdom. And that was then translated into Greek as Sophia. And already in the Book of the Wisdom of Solomon, this Chokmah is always addressed as she. And he's called the beloved and the consort of God. And all of the things that relate to wisdom and beauty and inspiration and prophecy are done by way of Sophia. She is the one, if you just look at the Book of the Wisdom, who does all these things, makes people into friends of God. So God, the God of the Old Testament in this case, works through Sophia. So we already have that image of the feminine wisdom, which is, you might say, is the effulgence, the light, in overshadowing light in Hebrew called Shekinah, of God, that comes down and overshadows humanity. So that it's really the divine woman who brings the mysteries to the individual and not the masculine God himself. This was a development in a sort of esoteric Judaism at that time, which then found its full expression and flowering among the Gnostics. But these and many other elements which came forth at that time were, they were simply not acceptable to an awful lot of people, even as they are not acceptable to many people today. I'm quite sure that if outstanding gentleman, the Reverend Jerry Falwell, would have the unique misfortune, but it would be probably our misfortune, if he were here and would hear this, would definitely put us on the bottom or the top or whatever, in the darkest point of the blacklist of the moral majority movement. Maybe we are there already. These things are unacceptable to certain kinds of minds, and they were unacceptable then. And then, of course, as most of you know, there are certain historical developments took place whereby the people who wanted to adhere to the old concepts, to Jehovah's law, rather than to the new law, took over, and while they maintained the trappings of Christianity, they really perpetuated that which the Christian religion was designed to supplant and do away with. And there went, of course, by the wayside, the Gnostics. But as Jung, of course, wisely pointed out, these transformative and creative ideas never really disappeared. They were funneled into alchemy. They were funneled into various other traditions. And they led an underground existence in their own way right up to the present time. Of course, there were also very small streams, let's say, wherein the Gnostic tradition remained in its original form or without disguising itself as alchemy or anything else, but these were rather minuscule. In my very early youth, made contact with some of these secret branches of Gnostics, who still call themselves Gnostics in France, particularly in the south of France, and I became one of them. And I brought as much as I could of these traditions over here to the West Coast myself. And then there are others. There are some in the Middle East who are called the Mandeans. Manda means Gnosis in late form of Aramaic. These folk lived primarily in Iraq, and they lived, those who, most of them killed probably by now by the glorious Ayatollah in Iran. So there were some who survived in that fashion, but for the most part it kept changing its external appearance, but it was always in growth. And so we might say that Jung had intuitively, because of his own Gnostic character, because of his Gnostic soul, Jung caught on to the essence of this tradition even before the documents were available which would have justified his vision. And that's the wonderful thing from a Gnostic point of view about Jung, that he knew all of this intuitively. And I sometimes irritate and torment the Gnostic scholars with that. You know, we have the largest concentration of Gnostic scholars, university scholars, in the whole world in Southern California. Well, I don't know, it's the new Alexandria, people just read them from everywhere, from Germany, from here, there, everywhere. And I told Dr. Robinson, who incidentally is a good friend of ours, he comes to our Gnostic services at Easter, and otherwise the editor of the Nachamadi manuscript. See, you gentlemen now slowly are beginning to find in the books, after you decipher the Coptic and so forth, what these things are like. Jung didn't need to read Coptic. Jung didn't need these books. He knew it already, and that's what makes a real Gnostic. That is why Jung was a Gnostic, while you are only scholars of Gnostic. They don't like that so much. Not when I put it that way, but of course, actually I have a great deal of affection for them because they are doing a very, very wonderful and very much needed work. We need both. We need the scholars and we need those who can catch these things by way of their intuition. So as our time progresses with us towards the conclusion, we need to kind of to wind up all of this, and we need to indicate that we are really, I think, at this time on the very threshold of a new gnosis in the West. Jung foresaw this and wrote in his work The Undiscovered Self as follows, when he spoke about the world crisis which is still upon us, that the present world crisis is characterized by a mood of world destruction and world renewal that has set its mark on our time. We are living, said Jung, in what the Greeks called the kairos, the right time for a metamorphosis of the gods, namely of the fundamental principles and symbols. This peculiarity of our time, which is certainly not of our conscious choosing, is the expression of the unconscious man within us who is changing. And so it appears to me, if I don't read the signs in the wrong manner, that after some 1600 years or so of suppression, the Gnostic effort for the unification of the soul, for the discovery of an individuational or transformational spirituality of a very effective and direct manner, is about to be reborn. And that one of the chief and most insightful and direct forces concerned with that rebirth were and are the efforts and the teachings of Carl Gustav Jung. And this, I think, is an extremely important and wonderful thing. But we need to draw the conclusions from it. I think a certain responsibility rests on the shoulders of those who have been attracted by way of their own intuition, by way of their own deeper feelings and spiritual experiences to the teaching of Jung, to namely to see these matters clearly and to have the courage and the directness to speak up for it. I think the time for compromising with the old law of limitation, the old law of being good, of believing the right things, the tyranny of the archaic Jehovah archetype, whether it is in its Calvinistic form or whether it is in its Marxist form, where it is also present for that matter, or in its Freudian form. We might as well kick them all a bit. Why? The time to compromise with these outmoded archetypal manifestations is past. And those of us who have been attracted to these truths of the soul, I think, ought to have the courage to speak up for it. But otherwise, history in some manner might repeat itself. We see certain retrogressive and reactionary trends in our culture right now. I am not that concerned about politics. That's not the problem. That's just a symbol. The people who are in the White House and in Congress are the projections of the collective unconscious, and how unconscious it is of our culture and of our people. But we need to look at it at a deeper level. And it only takes really a relatively few persons of insight and courage to keep this flame burning. Now, I don't look or act like some kind of a 60s hippie. I'm even one of the people who doesn't have a great deal of regard for the, quote, New Age mentality. I think the New Age is old hat by now. But I do feel that a great manifestation of the kairos, of the right time, have taken place in the 1960s and in the 1970s in our culture. And there is a tremendous amount of valuable material there. thousands and thousands and hundred thousands and millions of people of all ages have had Gnostic experiences. And they are trying to put them into the myth right now. Sometimes these myths seem crazy, and maybe they are. Myths of flying saucers, myths of crystals that are going to cure you, myths of all kinds of cockeyed diets and holy, so-called holistic medicine, and gobbling wheatgrass, and smoking and eating and brewing noxious weeds. And, you know, just dreadful things that my Hungarian culinary aesthetics revolts against, and so forth. But quite aside from that, these are the attempts to put into some kind of a myth the gigantic transformative Gnostic experiences which have come to our culture, people in our culture, on a tremendously wide scale. Not just a little elite, not just a few people here and there, but millions of people. Now, we cannot allow this to get lost. We cannot allow this to get mired down in the activities of the right-to-lifers, in the activities of Jerry Falwells, and in the activities of just nice, good people who woke up for a few years and who are ready to go to sleep again. Well, if they want to go to sleep, it's all right. Maybe. But we shall not. You know, one of the most energetic to me at least inspiring mythological figures of the Gnostic mythos is one whom Jung wrote about with a great deal of fervor in the Seven Sermons to the Dead. It's the figure of Abraxas. And that was the figure that Basilides, one of the Gnostic teachers in Alexandria, wrote about. Abraxas was a mythological figure portrayed as a hybrid being having the head of a rooster, the torso of a man, and the legs fashioned like a serpent. And he rides over the sky above the stars with a great big whip and carrying a shield, and he cries with the voice of the rooster at the celestial chanticleer to awaken the universe. His is the voice crying, shouting in the celestial night, in the dark night, awaken, awaken. And that is really the voice of the Gnostic at our time. It's called the Jungian, they call it anything else. We have the responsibility to keep the spirit awake. We have the responsibility to prevent humanity from falling into the dark sleep of unconsciousness, wherein it was for such a long time. And I think occasions such as this, when we get together and reflect over these matters, will help us to live up to that responsibility. And if to some extent and degree our being here together has contributed to that, then I think my visit here has once again been very, very good. So thank you very much, and I stop at that point.
And that is the end of the tape. Copyright C.G. Jung Society, Seattle, and the speaker. All rights reserved. No copying, please.